meant by wringing the Spaniards' lugs. And, laughing heartily, if it puts a couple of thousand guineas in our pockets, why, so much the better. "May I come in, sir?" asked the purser, appearing in the open door. "Good morning, Mr. Ricketts. Come in, come in and sit down. Are those today's figures?" "Yes, sir." "You'll not be pleased, I'm afraid. The second butt in the lower tier was started in the head, and it must have lost close on 50 gallon." "Then we must pray for rain, Mr. Ricketts," said Jack. But when the purser had gone, he turned sadly to Stephen. "I should have been perfectly happy but for that damned water. Everything delightful, people behaving well, charming crews, no sickness. If only I'd completed our water at Marne. Even at short allowance we use half a ton a day, what with all these prisoners and in this heat. The meat has to be soaked and the grog has to be mixed, even if we do wash in sea-water." He had wholly set his heart on lying in the sea lanes of Barcelona, perhaps the busiest convergency in the Mediterranean. That was to have been the culmination of the cruise. Now he would have to bear away for Menorca, and he was by no means sure of what welcome would be waiting for him there, or what orders. Not much of his cruising time was left, and capricious winds, or a capricious commandant, might swallow it entirely. Almost certainly would. "If it is fresh water you're wanting, I can show you a creek not far from here where you may fill all the barrels you choose."
"Why did you never tell me?" cried Jack, shaking him by the hand and looking delighted. A disagreeable sight, for the left side of his face, head and neck was still seared a baboonish red and blue. It shone under Stephen's medicated grease, and through the grease rose a new frizz of yellow hair. All this, taken with his deep brown, shaved other cheek, gave him a wicked, degenerate, inverted look. "You never asked."
"Undefended, no batteries?"
"Never a house, far less a gun."
"Yet it was inhabited once, for there are the remains of a Roman villa on the top of the promontory, and you can just make out the road beneath the trees and the undergrowth, cistus and lentisk. No doubt they used the spring. It's quite considerable, and it may, I conceive, have real medicinal qualities. The country people use it in cases of impotence."
"And can you find it, do you think?"
"Yes," said Stephen. He sat for a moment with his head down. "Listen," he said, "will you do me a kindness?"
"With all my heart." "I have a friend who lives some 2 or 3 miles inland. I should like you to land me and pick me up, say, 12 hours later."
"Very well," said Jack. It was fair enough.
"Very well," he said again, looking aside to hide the knowing grin that would spread over his face. "It is the night you would wish to spend ashore, I presume?"
"We'll stand in this evening. You're sure we'll not be surprised?"
"Quite sure."
"Send the cutter in again a little after sunrise. But what if I'm forced off the land? What would you do then?"
"I should present myself the next morning, or the morning after that, a whole series of mornings, if need be."
"I must go," he said, getting up at the sound of the bell, the still feeble bell, that his new loblolly boy rang to signify that the sick might now assemble. "I dare not trust that fellow alone with the drugs." The sin-eater had discovered a malignance towards his shipmates. He had been found grinding Creta alba into their gruel, under the persuasion that it was a far more active substance, far more sinister. And if ill will had been enough, the sick bay would have been swept clean days ago.
The cutter, followed by the launch, rowed attentively in through the warm darkness, with Dillon and Sergeant Quinn keeping watch on the sides of the high wooded inlet.
and when the boats were 200 yards from the cliff, the exhalation of the stone pines, mixed with the scent of the gum cistus, met them. It was like breathing another element. "If you row a little more to the right," said Stephen, "you may avoid the rocks where the crayfish live." In spite of the heat, he had his black cloak over his shoulders, and sitting huddled there in the stern sheets, he stared into the narrowing cove with a singular intensity, looking deathly pale. The stream, in times of spate, had formed a little bar, and upon this the cutter grounded. Everybody leapt out to float it over, and two seamen carried Stephen ashore. They put him down tenderly, well above the high water mark, adjured him to take care of all them nasty sticks laying about, and hurried back for his cloak. Falling and falling, the water had made a basin in the rock at the top of the beach, and here the sailors filled their barrels while the marines stood guard at the outward extremities. "What an agreeable dinner it was," observed Dillon, sitting with Stephen upon a smooth rock, warm through and through, convenient to their hams. "I've rarely eaten a better," said Stephen, "never at sea." Jack had acquired a French cook from the Santa Lucia, a royalist volunteer, and he was putting on weight like a prize ox. "You were in a very copious flow of spirits, too." "That was clean against the naval etiquette. At a captain's table you speak when you are spoken to, and you agree. It makes for a tolerably dismal entertainment, but that is the custom. And after all, he does represent the king, I suppose. But I felt I should cast etiquette adrift, and make a particular exertion, should try to do the civil thing far more than usual. I've not been altogether fair to himself, you know, far from it," he added, nodding towards the sofa. "And 'twas handsome to invite me." "He does love a prize. But prize-taking is not his prime concern." "Just so. Though in passing, I may say, not everyone would know it. He does himself injustice. I do not think the men know it, for example. If they were not kept well in check by the steady officers, the boatswain and the gunner, and I must admit that fellow marshal, too, I think there would be trouble with them. There may be still. Prize money is heady stuff. From prize money to breaking bulk and plunder is no great step. There has been some already. And from plunder and drunkenness to breaking out entirely, and even to mutiny itself, is not a terrible long way further. Mutinies always happen in ships where the discipline is either too lax or too severe." "You're mistaken, sure, when you say they don't know him. Unlearned men have a wonderful penetration in these matters. Have you ever known a village reputation to be wrong? It's a penetration that seems to dissipate with a little education, somewhat as the ability to remember poetry will go. I have known peasants who could recite 2,000 or 3,000 verses. But would you indeed say our discipline is relaxed? It surprises me, but then I know so little of naval things." "No. What is commonly called discipline is quite strict with us. What I mean is something else. The intermediate terms, they might be called. A commander is obeyed by his officers because he is himself obeying. The thing is not, in its essence, personal, and so down. If he does not obey, the chain weakens." "How grave I am, for all love. It was that poor unlucky soldier at Mahon I was thinking of brought all this morality into my mind. Do you not find it happens very often that you are as gay as Garrick at dinner, and then by supper time you wonder why God made the world?" "I do. Where is the connection with the soldier?" "It was prize money we fought over. He said the whole thing was unfair. He was very angry and very poor.
But he would have it. We sea officers were in the Navy for that reason alone. I told him he was mistaken, and he told me I lied. We walked to those long gardens at the top end of the quay. I had Jevons of the Implacable with me. And it was over in two passes. Poor, stupid, clumsy fellow. He came straight onto my point. What now, Shanahan?
Your Honour, the casks are full.
Bung them up tight then and we'll get them down to the water.
Goodbye,
said Stephen, standing up.
We lose you then? Said James.
Yes, I'm going up before it grows too dark.
Yet it would have had to be strangely dark for his feet to have missed this path. It wound up, crossing and recrossing the stream. Its steps kept open by the odd fishermen after crayfish, the impotent men going to bathe in the pool, and by a few other travellers. And his hand reached out of itself for the branch that would help him over a deep place, a branch polished by many hands. Up and up, and the warm air sighing through the pines. At one point he stepped out onto a bare rock, and there, wonderfully far below already, rowed the boats with their train of almost sunken barrels, not unlike the spaced-out eggs of the common toad. Then the path ran back under the trees, and he didn't emerge again until he was on the thyme and the short turf, the rounded top of the promontory jutting out bare from the sea of pines. Apart from a violet haze on the farther hills and a startling band of yellow in the sky, the colour had all gone. But he saw white scuts bobbing away, and as he had expected, there were the half-seen forms of shadowy nightjars wheeling and darting, turning like ghosts over his head. He sat down by a great stone that said, Non fui, non sum, non curo, and gradually the rabbits came back, nearer and nearer, until on the windward side he could indeed hear their quick nibbling in the thyme. He meant to sit there until dawn, and to establish a continuity in his mind, if that could be done. The friend, though existent, was a mere pretext. Silence, darkness, and these countless familiar scents and the warmth of the land had become, in their way, as necessary to him as air.
I think we may run in now, said Jack. It'll do no harm to be before our time, for I should like to stretch my legs a little. In any case, I should like to see him as early as can be. I'm uneasy with him ashore. There are times when I feel he shouldn't be allowed out alone. And then again there are times when I feel he could command a fleet, almost. The Sophie had been standing off and on, and it was now the end of the middle watch, with James Dillon relieving the master. They might just as well take advantage of having all hands on deck to tack the sloop, observed Jack, wiping the dew off the taffrail and leaning upon it to stare down at the cutter towing astern, clearly visible in the phosphorescence of the milk-warm sea.
"That's where we filled, sir," said Babington, pointing up the shadowy beach. "And if it wasn't so dark, you could see the little sorts of path the doctor went up from here."
Jack walked over to stare at the path and to view the basin. He walked stumpily, for he couldn't come by his land legs right away. The ground would not heave and yield like a deck. But as he paced to and fro in the half-light, his body grew more used to the earth's rigidity, and in time his legs carried him with an easier, less rough and jerking action. He reflected upon the nature of the ground, upon the slow and uneven coming of the light, a progression by jerks, upon the agreeable change in his lieutenant since the brush at Almerera, and upon the curious alteration in the master, who was quite sullen at times. Dillon had a pack of hounds at home, 35 couple, had had some splendid runs. Famous country, it must be, and prodigious stout foxes to stand up so long. Jack had a great respect for a man who could show good sport with a pack of hounds. Dillon obviously knew a great deal about hunting and about horses. Yet it was strange he should mind so little about the noise his dogs made. For the cry of a tuneful pack, the Sophie's warning gun jerked him from these placid reflections. He whipped round, and there was the smoke drifting down her side. A hoist of signals was racing up, but without his glass he wouldn't be able to make out the flags in this light. The sloop came round before the wind, and as though she could feel his perplexity of mind, she reverted to the oldest of all signals, her t'gallants loose and sheets flying, to say, "Strange sails in sight." And she emphasized this with a second gun. Jack glanced at his watch, and with longing into the motionless, silent pines, said, "Lend me your knife, Bondon," and picked up a big, flattish stone. "Regradia," he scratched on it, a notion of secrecy flitting through his mind, "with the time and his initials." He struck it into the top of a little heap, took a last, hopeless look into the wood, and leapt aboard. The moment the cutter was alongside, the Sophie's yards creaked round, she filled and pointed straight out to sea. "Men of war, sir, I'm almost certain," said James. "I thought you would wish us to get into the offing." "Very right, Mr. Dillon," said Jack. "Will you lend me your glass?" At the masthead, with his breath coming back, and the light of day broad over the sharp, unmisted sea, he could make them out clearly. Two ships to windward coming up fast from the south with all sails set. Men of war for a 10-pound note. English, French, Spanish. There was more wind out there, and they must be running a good 10 knots. He glanced over his left shoulder at the landing, trending away eastwards out to sea. The Sophie would have a devil of a job rounding that cape before they were up with her, yet she must do so or be shut in. Yes, they were men of war. They were hull up now. And although he couldn't count the ports, they were probably heavy frigates. 36-gun frigates. Frigates for sure. If the Sophie rounded the cape first, she might have a chance. And if she ran through the shoal water between the point and the reef beyond it, she would gain half a mile, for no deep-drafted frigate could follow her there. "We'll send the people to their breakfast, Mr. Dillon," he said, "and then clear for action. If there's to be a dust-up, we might just as well have full bellies for it." But there were few bellies that filled themselves heartily aboard the Sophie that brilliant morning. A kind of impatient rigidity kept the oatmeal and hardtack from going down regular and smooth. And even Jack's freshly roasted, freshly ground coffee wasted its scent on the quarter-deck, as the officers stood very carefully gauging the respective courses, speeds, and likely points of convergence. Two frigates to windward, a hostile coast to leeward, and the likelihood of being embayed. It was enough to take the edge off any appetite. "Deck!" called the lookout from within the pyramid of tightly drawing canvas. "She's breaking out her colours, sir. Blue ensign." "Aye," said Jack, "I dare say. Mr. Ricketts, reply with the same." Now every glass in the Sophie was trained upon the nearer frigate's fore-t'gallant for the private signal. For although anyone could heave out a blue ensign, only a king's ship could show the secret mark of recognition. There it was, a red flag at the fore, followed a moment later by a white flag and a pendant at the main,
and the faint boom of a windward gun. All the tension slackened at once.
"Very well," said Jack. "Reply, and then make our number. Mr. Day, 3 guns to leeward in slow time."
"She's the San Fiorenzo, sir," said James, helping the flustered midshipman with the signal book, whose prettily coloured pages would race out of control in the freshening breeze. "And she's signalling for Sophie's captain."
"Christ," said Jack inwardly.
The San Fiorenzo's captain was Sir Harry Neal, who had been first lieutenant of the Resolution when Jack was her most junior midshipman, and then his captain in the Success. A great stickler for promptness, cleanliness, perfection of dress, and hierarchy. Jack was unshaved. What hair he had left was in all directions. Stephen's bluish grease covered one half of his face. But there was no help for it. "Bear up to closer, then," he said, and darted into his cabin.
"Here you are at last," said Sir Harry, looking at him with marked distaste.
"By God, Captain Aubrey, you take your time." The frigate seemed enormous. After the Sophie, her towering masts might have been those of a first-rate ship of the line. Acres of pale decks stretched away on either hand. He had a ludicrous and, at the same time, a very painful feeling of being crushed down to a far smaller size, as well as that of being reduced all at once from a position of total authority to one of total subservience.
"I beg pardon, sir," he said without expression. "Now, come into the cabin. Your appearance don't change much, Aubrey," he remarked, waving towards a chair.
"However, I'm quite glad of the meeting. We're overburdened with prisoners, and mean to discharge 50 of them into you."
"I'm sorry, sir, truly sorry, not to be able to oblige you, but the sloop is crowded with prisoners already."
"Oblige, did you say? You will oblige me, sir, by obeying orders. Are you aware that I'm the senior captain here, sir? Besides, I know damn well you've been sending prize crews into Mahon. These prisoners can occupy their room. Anyhow, you can land them in a few days' time, so let's hear no more of it."
"But what about my crews, sir?"
"I'm less concerned with your crews, sir, than with the good of the service. Let the transfer be carried out as quickly as possible, because I have further orders for you. We're sweeping for an American ship, the John B. Christopher. She is on her passage from Marseille to the United States, calling at Barcelona, and we expect to find her between Mallorca and the Main. Among her passengers, she may have 2 rebels, United Irishmen. The one a Romish priest called Mangan, and the other a fellow by the name of Roach, Patrick Roach. They are to be taken off by force if necessary. They will probably be using French names and have French passports. They speak French. Here's their description. A middle-aged, spare man, about 40 years old, of a brown complexion and dark brown-coloured hair, but wears a wig. A hooked nose, a sharp chin, grey eyes, and a large mole near his mouth. That's the parson. T'other is a tall, stout man, about 6 foot high, black hair and blue eyes, about 35, has the little finger of his left hand cut off, and walks stiff from a wound in his leg. You'd better take these printed sheets."
"Mr. Dillon, prepare to receive 25 prisoners from San Fiorenzo and 25 from Amelia," said Jack. "And then we're to join in a sweep for some rebels."
"Rebels?" cried James.
"Yes," said Jack absently, peering beyond him at the slack foretopsail bowline, and breaking off to call out an order. "Yes, pray glance at these sheets when you have leisure." "Leisure, forsooth."
50 more mouths," said the purser. "What do you say to that, Mr. Marshall? 3 and 30 full allowances. Where in God's name am I supposed to find it all?"
"'We shall have to put into Mahon straight away, Mr. Ricketts. "'That's what I say to it. "'And kiss my hand to the crews. 50 is impossible, and that's flat. "'You never saw two officers look so glum in your life. 50!
50 more of the buggers,' said James Sheehan, "'and all for their own imperial convenience. "'Jesus, Mary and Joseph!
"'And think of our poor doctor! "'All alone among them damn trees, where there might be owls!' God damn the service, I say, and the fucking San Fiorenzo and the bleeding Amelia, too.
Alone?
Don't you think it, mate. But damn the service to hell, just as you say.
It was in this mood that the Sophie stretched away to the northwest on the outward or right-hand extremity of the sweeping line. The Amelia lay half topsails down on her larboard beam, and the San Fiorenzo the same distance inshore of the Amelia, quite out of sight of the Sophie, and in the best position for picking up any slow prize that offered. Between them, they could oversee 60 miles of the clear-skied Mediterranean. And so they sailed all day long. It was indeed a long day, full and busy. The forehold to clear, the prisoners to stow away and guard, many of them privateersmen, a dangerous crew, three slow-witted, heavy merchantmen to scurry after, all neutrals and all unwilling to heave to, but one did report a ship, thought to be American, fishing her injured foretopmast 2 days' sail to windward, and the incessant trimming of the sails and the shifting, uncertain, dangerously gusty wind to keep up with the frigates. The Sophie's very best would only just avoid disgrace. And she was short-handed. Mowat, Pullings, and old Alexander, a reliable quartermaster, were away in prizes, together with nearly a third of her best men, so that James Dillon and the master had to keep watch and watch. Tempers ran short, too, and the defaulters' list lengthened as the day wore on.
"I didn't think Dillon could be so savage," thought Jack, as his lieutenant roared up into the foretop, making the weeping Babington and his reduced band of topmen set the larboard topsail studding sail afresh for the third time. It was true that the sloop was flying along at a splendid pace for her, but in a way it was a pity to flog her so, to badger the men. Too high a price to pay. However, that was the service, and he certainly must not interfere. His mind returned to its many problems and to worrying about Stephen. It was sheer madness, this rambling about on a hostile shore. And then again he was profoundly dissatisfied with himself for his performance aboard the San Fiorenzo. A gross abuse of authority. He should have dealt with it firmly. Yet there he was, bound hand and foot by the printed instructions and the articles of war. And then again there was the problem of midshipmen. The sloop needed at least two more, a youngster and an oldster. He would ask Dillon if there was any boy he chose to nominate, cousin, nephew, godchild. It was a handsome compliment for a captain to pay his lieutenant, not unusual when they liked one another. As for the oldster, he wanted someone with experience. Best of all, someone who could be rated master's mate almost at once. His thoughts dwelt upon his coxswain, a fine seaman and captain of the maintop. Then they moved on to consider the younger men belonging to the lower deck. He would far, far rather have someone who came in through the hawse hole, a plain sailor-man like young Pullings, than most of the youths whose families could afford to send them to sea. If the Spaniards caught Stephen Maturin, they'd shoot him for a spy. It was almost dark by the time the third merchantman had been dealt with, and Jack was shattered with fatigue, red eyes prickling, ears four times too sharp, and a feeling like a tight cord round his temples. He'd been on deck all day, an anxious day that began 2 hours before first light, and he went to sleep almost before his head was down. Yet in that brief interval his darkening mind had time for two darts of intuition.
The one stating that all was well with Stephen Maturin, the other that with James Dillon it was not. I had no notion he minded so about the cruise, though no doubt he's grown attached to Maturin too. A strange fellow, he said, sinking right down. Down, down, into the perfect sleep of an exhausted, healthy, well-fed, young, fattish man. A rosy sleep. Yet not so far that he didn't wake sharply after a few hours, frowning and uneasy. Low, urgent, quarrelling voices came whispering in through the stern window. For a moment he thought of a surprise, a boat attack, boarding in the night. But then his more woken mind recognised them as Dillon's and Marshall's. And he sank back. Yet, said his mind a great while later, and still in sleep, how do they both come to be on the quarter-deck at this time of the night, when they're keeping watch and watch? It's not eight bells. As if to confirm this statement, the Sophie's bell struck three times, and from various points all through the sloop came the low, answering cries of "All's well." But it was not. She was not under the same press of sail. What was amiss? He huddled on his dressing gown and went on deck. Not only had the Sophie reduced sail, but her head was pointing east-northeast by east.
"Sir," said Dillon, stepping forward, "this is my responsibility entirely. I overruled the master and ordered the helm to be put up. I believe there is a ship on the starboard bow."
Jack stared into the silvery haze, moonlight and a half-covered sky. The swell had increased. He saw no ship, no light, but that proved nothing. He picked up the traverse board and looked at the change of course.
"We shall be in with the coast of Mallorca directly," he said, yawning.
"Yes, sir. So I took the liberty of reducing sail."
It was an extraordinary breach of discipline. But Dillon knew that as well as he did. There was no good purpose to be served in telling him of it publicly.
"Whose watch is it at present?"
"Mine, sir," said the master. He spoke quietly, but in a voice almost as harsh and unnatural as Dillon's.
There were strange currents here, much stronger than any ordinary disagreement about a ship's light.
"Who's aloft?"
"Assay, sir."
Assay was an intelligent, reliable Lascar.
"Assay, ahoy!"
"Hollo!"
the thin pipe from the darkness above.
"What do you see?"
"See nothing, sir. See star no more."
But then there would be nothing obvious about such a fleeting glimpse. Dillon was probably right. He would never have done such an extraordinary thing else. Yet this was a damned odd course. "Are you quite persuaded about your light, Mr. Dillon?"
"Fully persuaded, sir. Quite happy."
Happy was the strangest word to hear said in that grating voice. Jack made no reply for some moments. Then he altered the course a point and a half to the north and began pacing up and down his habitual walk. By four bells the light was mounting fast from the east, and there, indeed, was the dark presence of the land on their starboard bow, dim through the vapours that hung over the sea. Though the high bowl of the sky was clear, something between blue and darkness. He went below to put on some clothes, and while the shirt was still over his head, there was the cry of a sail. She came sailing out of a brownish band of mist, a bare 2 miles to leeward,
and as soon as he'd cleared it, Jack's glass picked out the fished foretopmast with no more than a close-reefed topsail on it. Everything was clear. Everything was plain. Dillon had been perfectly right, of course. Here was their quarry. Though strangely off its natural course, it must have tacked some time ago off Dragon Island, and now it was slowly making its way into the open channel to the south. In an hour or so, their disagreeable task would be done, and he knew very well what he would be at by noon.
"Well done, Mr. Dillon," he cried. "Well done indeed. We couldn't have fallen in with her better. I should never have believed it so far to the east of the channel. Show her our colours and give her a gun."
The John B. Christopher was a little shy of what might prove a hungry man of war, eager to impress all her English seamen, or anyone else the boarding party chose to consider English. But she had not the least chance of escape, above all with a wounded topmast and her topgallant mast struck down on deck. So after a slight flurry of canvas and a tendency to fall off, she backed her topsails, showed the American flag, and waited for the Sophie's boat.
"You shall go," said Jack to Dillon, who was still hunched over his telescope, as though absorbed in some point of the American's rigging. "You speak French better than any of us, now the doctor's away. And after all, you discovered her in this extraordinary place. She's your discovery. Should you like the printed papers again, or shall you—"
Jack broke off. He'd seen a very great deal of drunkenness in the Navy. Drunken admirals, post captains, commanders, drunken ship's boys 10 years old, and he'd been trundled aboard on a wheelbarrow himself before now, but he disliked it on duty. He disliked it very much indeed, above all at such an hour in the morning.
"Perhaps Mr. Marshall had better go," he said coldly.
"Pass the word for Mr. Marshall."
"Oh, no, sir," cried Dillon, recovering himself. "I beg your pardon. It was a momentary—" "I am perfectly well."
And to be sure, the sweating pallor, the bolted, staring look had gone, replaced by an unhealthy flush.
"Well," said Jack dubiously. And the next moment James Dillon was calling out very actively for the cutter's crew, hurrying up and down, checking their arms, hammering the flints of his own pistols, as clearly master of himself as possible. With the cutter alongside and ready to push off, he said,
"Perhaps I should beg for those sheets, sir. I will refresh my memory as we pull across."
Gently backing and filling, the Sophie kept on the John B. Christopher's larboard bow, prepared to rake her and cross her stem at the first sign of trouble. But there was none. A few more or less derisive cries of "Paul Jones" and "How's King George?" flooded across from the John B. Christopher's forecastle, and the grinning gun crew, standing there ready to blow their cousins to a better world without the least hesitation or the least ill will, would gladly have replied in kind, but their captain would have none of it. This was an odious task. No time for merriment. At the first call of Boston Beans, he rapped out, "Silence, fore and aft! Mr. Ricketts, take that man's name." Time wore on. In its tub, the slow match burned away coil by coil. All along the deck, attention wandered. A gannet passed overhead, brilliant white, and Jack found himself pondering anxiously about Stephen, forgetful of his duty. The sun rose. The sun rose. Now at last the boarding party were at the American's gangway, dropping down into the cutter, and there was Dillon alone. He was replying civilly to the master and to the passengers at the rail. The John B. Christopher was filling the odd colonial twang of her mate, urging the men to clap onto that tarnation brace, echoed across the sea.
and she was underway southwards. The Sophie's cutter was pulling across the intervening space. On the way out, James hadn't known what he'd do. All that day, ever since he'd heard of the squadron's mission, he'd been overwhelmed by a sense of fatality. And now, although he'd had hours to think about it, he still didn't know what he would do. He moved as though in a nightmare, going up the American side without the slightest volition of his own. And he had known, of course, that he would find Father Mangan. Although he'd done everything possible short of downright mutiny or sinking the Sophie to avoid it. Although he had altered course and shortened sail, blackmailing the master to accomplish it, he had known that he would find him. But what he'd not known, what he had never foreseen, was that the priest should threaten to denounce him if he did not turn a blind eye. He had disliked the man the moment recognition flashed between them, but in that very first moment he had made up his mind. There was not the slightest possibility of his playing the constable and taking them off. And then came this threat. For a second he had known with total certainty that it did not affect him in the least. But he had hardly reached another breath before the squalor of the situation became unbearable. He was obliged to make a slow pretense of examining all the other passports aboard before he could bring himself under control. He had known there was no way out, that whatever course he took would be dishonourable. But he had never imagined that dishonour could be so painful. He was a proud man. Father Mangan's satisfied leer wounded him beyond anything he had yet experienced. And with the pain of the wound there came a cloud of intolerable doubts. The boat touched the Sophie's side. "No such passengers aboard, sir," he reported. "So much the better," said Jack cheerfully, raising his hat to the American captain and waving it. "West or half south, Mr. Marshall, and house those guns, if you please." The exquisite fragrance of coffee drifted up from the after hatchway. "Dylan, come and breakfast with me," he said, taking him familiarly by the arm. "You're still looking most ghastly pale." "You must excuse me, sir," whispered James, disengaging himself with a look of utter hatred. "I am a little out of order."
Chapter 8. "I am entirely at a loss, upon my honour, and so I lay the position before you, confiding wholly in your candour. I am entirely at a loss. I cannot for the life of me conceive what manner of offence. It wasn't my landing of those monstrously unjust prisoners on Dragon Island, though he certainly disapproved of it, for the trouble began before that, quite early in the morning." Stephen listened gravely, attentively, never interrupting, and very slowly, harking back for details overlooked and forward to straighten his chronology by anticipation, Jack laid before him the history of his relations with James Dillon. Good, bad, with this last extraordinary descent not only inexplicable but strangely wounding, because of the real liking that had grown up in addition to the esteem. Then there was Marshall's unaccountable conduct, too, but that was of much less importance. With the utmost care, Jack reiterated his arguments about the necessity for having a happy ship if one was to command an efficient fighting machine. He quoted examples of like and contrary cases, and his audience listened and approved.
Stephen couldn't bring his wisdom to the resolution of any of these difficulties, however, nor, as Jack would somewhat ignobly have liked, could he propose his good offices, for he was a merely ideal interlocutor, and his thinking flesh lay 30 leagues to the south and west, across a waste of sea. A rough waste and across sea. After frustrating days of calm, light airs, and then a strong southwester, the wind had backed easterly in the night, and now it was blowing a gale across the waves that had built up during the day, so that the Sophie went thumping along under double-reefed topsails and courses, the cross-sea breaking over her weather-bow and soaking the lookout on the forecastle with a grateful spray, healing James Dillon as he stood on the quarter-deck communing with the devil, and rocking the cot in which Jack silently harangued the darkness. His was an exceedingly busy life. And yet, since he entered an inviolable solitude the moment he passed the sentry at his cabin door, it left him a great deal of time for reflection. It was not frittered away in very small exchanges, in listening to 3/4 of a scale on a quavering German flute, or in sailors' politics. I shall speak to him when we pick him up. I shall speak in the most general way of the comfort it is to a man to have a confidential friend aboard, and of this singularity in the sailor's life that one moment he is so on top of his shipmates, all hugger-mugger in the wardroom that he can hardly breathe, let alone play anything but a jig on the fiddle, and the next he's pitched into a kind of hermit's solitude, something he has never known before. In times of stress, Jack Aubrey had 2 main reactions. He either became aggressive or he became amorous. He longed either for the violent catharsis of action or for that of making love. He loved a battle. He loved a wench. "I quite understand that some commanders take a girl to sea with them," he reflected. "Apart from the pleasure, think of the refuge of sinking into a warm, lively, affectionate peace." "I wish there were a girl in this cabin," he added after a pause. This disarray, this open, acknowledged incomprehension, were kept solely for his cabin and his ghostly companion. The outward appearance of the Sophie's captain had nothing hesitant about it, and it would have been a singularly acute observer to tell that the nascent friendship between him and his lieutenant had been cut short. The master was such an observer, however. For although Jack's truly hideous appearance when singed and greased had caused a revulsion for a while, at the same time Jack's obvious liking for James Dillon had set up a jealousy that worked in the contrary direction. Furthermore, the master had been threatened in terms that left almost no room for doubt, in very nearly direct terms. And so, for an entirely different cause, he watched the captain and the lieutenant with painful anxiety. "Mr. Marshall," said Jack in the darkness, and the poor man jumped as though a pistol had been fired behind him, "when do you reckon we shall raise the land?" "In about 2 hours' time, sir, if this wind holds." "Yes, I thought as much," said Jack, gazing up into the rigging. "I believe you may shake out a reef now, however, and at any further slackening, set the t'gallants. Crack on all you can, and have me called when land is seen, if you please, Mr. Marshall." Something less than 2 hours later, he reappeared to view the remote, irregular line on the starboard bow. Spain, with the singular mountain the English called Eggtop Hill, in line with the best bower anchor, and their watering bay, therefore, directly ahead. "By God, you're a prime navigator, Marshal," he said, lowering his glass. "You deserve to be master of the fleet." It would take them at least an hour to run in, however. And now that the event was so close at hand, no longer at all theoretical, Jack discovered how anxious he was in fact, how very much the outcome mattered to him. "Send my coxswain aft, will you?" he said, returning to his cabin after he'd taken 6 uneasy turns. Barrett Bondon,
coxswain and captain of the main top, was unusually young for his post. A fine, open-looking creature, tough without brutality, cheerful, perfectly in his place, and, of course, a prime seaman, bred to the sea from childhood. "Sit down, Bondon," said Jack, a little consciously, for what he was about to offer was the quarter-deck, no less, and the possibility of advancement to the very pinnacle of the sailor's hierarchy. "I've been thinking, should you like to be rated midshipman?" "Why, no, sir, not at all," answered Bondon at once, his teeth flashing in the gloom. "But I thank you very kindly for your good opinion, sir." "Oh?" said Jack, taken aback. "Why not?" "I ain't got the learning, sir." "Why," laughing cheerfully, "it's all I can do to read the watch list, spelling it out slow, and I'm too old to wear round now. And then, sir, what should I look like, rigged out like an officer? Jack in the green. And my old messmates laughing up their sleeves and calling out, 'What ho, the hawse hole!'" "Plenty of fine officers began on the lower deck," said Jack. "I was on the lower deck myself once," he added, regretting the sequence as soon as he'd uttered it. "I know he was, sir," said Bondon, and his grin flashed again. "How did you know that?" "We got a cove in the starboard watch with shipmates with you, sir, in the old Rezzo off the Cape." "Oh, dear, oh, dear," cried Jack inwardly, "and I never noticed him. So there I was, turning all the women ashore as righteous as pompous pilot, and they knew all the time. Well, well." And aloud, with a certain stiffness, "Well, Bondon, think of what I've said. It would be a pity to stand in your own way." "If I may make so bold, sir," said Bondon, getting to his feet and standing there, suddenly constrained, lumpish and embarrassed, "there's my Aunt Sloper's George. George Lucock, foretopman, larboard watch. He's a right scholar, can write so small you can hardly see it. Younger nor I am, and more supple, sir. Oh, far more supple." "Lucock?" said Jack dubiously. "He's only a lad. Wasn't he flogged last week?" "Yes, sir. But it was only his gun and one again, and he couldn't hold back from his draft, not in duty to the giver." "Well," said Jack, reflecting that perhaps there might be wiser prizes than a bottle, though none so valued, "I'll keep an eye on him." Midshipmen were much in his mind during this tedious working in. "Mr. Babington," he said, suddenly stopping in his up and down, "take your hands out of your pockets. When did you last write home?" Mr. Babington was at an age when almost any question evokes a guilty response, and this was, in fact, a valid accusation. He reddened and said, "I don't know, sir." "Think, sir, think," said Jack, his good-tempered face clouding unexpectedly. "What port did you send it from? Mahon? Leghorn? Genoa? Gibraltar?" "Now, never mind." There was no dark figure to be made out on that distant beach. "Never mind. Write a handsome letter, 2 pages at least, and send it in to me with your daily workings tomorrow. Give your father my compliments and tell him my bankers are whores." For Jack, like most other captains, managed the youngster's parental allowance for them. "Whores," he repeated absently once or twice. "My bankers are whores." And a strangled, ugly, crowing noise made him turn. Young Ricketts was clinging to the fall of the main Burton tackle in an attempt to control himself, but without much success. Jack's cold glare chilled his mirth, however, and he was able to reply to, "And you, Mr. Ricketts, have you written to your parents recently?" with an audible, "No, sir," that scarcely quavered at all. "Then you will do the same. 2 pages, wrote small, and no demands for new quadrants, laced hats or hangers," said Jack. And something told the midshipman that this was no time to expostulate, to point out that his loving parent, his only parent, was in daily, even hourly, communication with him. Indeed, this awareness of Jack's state of tension was general throughout the brig.
"Goldilocks is in a rare old taking about the doctor," they said. "Watch out for squalls." And when hammocks were piped up, the seamen who had to pass by him to stow theirs in the starboard quarter-deck netting glanced at him nervously. One, trying to keep an eye on the quartermaster and on the break of the deck and on his captain all at the same time, fell flat on his face. But Goldilocks was not the only one to be anxious by any manner of means. And when Stephen Maturin was at last seen to walk out of the trees and cross the beach to meet the jolly boat, a general exclamation of "There he is!" broke out from waist to forecastle in defiance of good discipline. "Huzzay!" "How very glad I am to see you," cried Jack, as Stephen groped his way aboard, pushed and pulled by well-meaning hands. "How are you, my dear sir? Come and breakfast directly. I've held it back on purpose. How do you find yourself? Tolerably spry, I hope, tolerably spry?"
"I am very well, I thank you," said Stephen, who indeed looked somewhat less cadaverous, flushed as he was with pleasure at the open friendliness of his welcome. "I will take a look at my sick bay, and then I will share your bacon with the utmost pleasure. Good morning, Mr. Day. Take off your hat, if you please."
"Very neat, very neat. You do us credit, Mr. Day, but no exposure to the sun as yet. I recommend the wearing of a close Welsh wig. Cheslin, good morning to you. You have a good account of our patients, I trust?"
"That," he said, a little greasy from bacon, "that was a point that exercised my mind a good deal during your absence. Would my loblolly boy pay the men back in their own coin? Would they return to their persecution of him? How quickly could he come by a new identity?"
"Identity?" said Jack, comfortably pouring out more coffee. "Is not identity something you're born with?"
"The identity I'm thinking of is something that hovers between a man and the rest of the world, a midpoint between his view of himself and theirs of him. For each, of course, affects the other continually. A reciprocal fluxion, sir. There is nothing absolute about this identity of mine. Were you personally, to spend some days in Spain at present, you would find yours change, you know, because of the general opinion there that you are a false, harsh, brutal, murdering villain, an odious man."
"I dare say they are vexed," said Jack, smiling, "and I dare say they call me Beelzebub. But that don't make me Beelzebub."
"Does it not? Does it not?"
"Ah. Well, however that may be, you have angered, you have stirred up the mercantile interest along the coast to a most prodigious degree. There is a wealthy man by the name of Mateu who is wonderfully incensed against you. The quicksilver belonged to him, and being contraband, it was not insured. So did the vessel you cut out at Almerera. And the cargo of the tartan burnt off Tortosa, half of that was his. He is well with the ministry, he has moved their indolence, and they have allowed him and his friends to charter one of their men of war."
"Not charter, my dear sir. No private person can possibly charter a man of war, a national vessel, a king's ship, not even in Spain."
"Oh? Perhaps I use the wrong term. I often use the wrong term in naval matters. However, a ship of force, not only to protect the coasting trade, but even more to pursue the Sophie, who is perfectly well known now, both by name and by description. This I had from Mateo's own cousin as we danced."
"You danced?" cried Jack, far more astonished than if Stephen had said, "as we ate our cold roast baby."
"Certainly I danced. Why would I not dance, pray?"
"Certainly you ought to dance. Most uncommon graceful, I'm sure. I only wondered. But did you indeed go about dancing?"
"I did."
"You've not travelled in Catalonia, sir, I believe."
"Not I."
"Then I must tell you that on Sunday mornings it is the custom in that country for people of all ages and conditions to dance on coming out of church. So I was dancing with Ramon Mateu y Cadafalc in the square before the Cathedral Church of Tarragona, where I had gone to hear the Palestrina Missa Brevis.
The dance is a particular dance, a round called the Sardana. And if you will reach me your fiddle, I will play you the air of the one I have in mind. Though you must imagine I am a harsh, braying hoboy. Plays.